Richard Skipper celebrates. Every show is a celebration. Each show, Richard delivers the artists you love, showcasing what makes them unique. Never gossipy. The antidote to a sometimes hectic world. Now, here's your host, Richard Skipper.
Happy Wednesday, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of Richard Skipper Celebrates. Today also marks 1 year since we did our first podcast a year ago today with Leslie Ann Warren. And I am very, very excited about today's guest. I have been a fan of Melanie Chartoff's for so long, seeing her on Seinfeld and the Bob Newhart Show and Friday Nights, which I used to love, and so many other things which we're going to talk about today. But the main reason we're here today is to talk about her new book, Odd Woman Out, Exposure in Stories and Essays. Or is it essays and stories? It's one of those. But anyway, I am so excited that she's here today. Before I bring her on, I'm going to show a little promo, and then you'll meet Melanie on the other side.
Hi, I'm Melanie Chartoff, and when I began recalling all the remarkable things that have happened to me over 50 years as an actor-performer looking for true love, I thought I was writing a stage play.
So I pay, I get Tyrone Brown bagged, and I turn around, and suddenly, I am hit by a blinding bank of spotlights.
And we're rolling.
It's entertainment tonight.
Or a stand-up act.
His animal impersonations are astounding. Trumpeting elephant, growling tigers, bitten kittens.
Or a movie.
I'm leaving your father. Huh? I borrowed a couple suitcases and I put them in my car trunk. I've been putting stuff out there for weeks, leaving dummy clothes in the closets.
You planned this all out.
He's going in for gallbladder removal on Monday. That way, if he has a heart attack, he's already in the hospital.
Or maybe a musical memoir.
Escape. Want to see the jerk. Everybody. Come on. I don't really love you. You're just my excuse for the...
But a literary agent saw me perform. I would up my estrogen and testosterone allotted to me on menopause and ignite my lust. I'd put myself in heat. And she said, "You're writing a book." And she was right. A book, an ebook, and an audiobook narrated by me. Odd Woman Out, Exposure in Essays and Stories is now available on Amazon.com.
And what an incredible listen it is. I've been listening on the Audible books in your own voice. So it's been incredible. Before we delve into your story, we are, unfortunately, still in the middle of a pandemic. Today marks 356 days since our theaters shut down here in New York. I know that you're in L.A., but it's across the board from coast to coast. I want to know how you're dealing with everything, really, in the midst of this crazy world that we're living in. And welcome today.
Thank you. Thank you. Great to be here. And I'm so happy that I created this relationship with your ear before we met. Like most actors, I'm just heartbroken about the impossibility, implausibility of big life theater for a while. I just mourn for my many friends who are so talented, but a lot of us have adapted and we're doing Zoom plays and performances. I've actually been rather virtually active. And fortunately for me, I kind of placed this book just as pandemic came down. So I've been preoccupied during this torturous period of time, doing a lot of publicity, a lot of editing, really discerning what I had already said in the book, what I could, you know, I had already mentioned enough crazy boyfriends, I could cut maybe 10. And I put the finishing touches on the book, and it came out in the beginning of February. It takes a while for these books to gestate. Mm-hmm. But I've been very busy writing my next book, which is a book of Corona poetry, some very black comic, some very elegiac. And I hope to get that out in another year from now when COVID is just a silly memory. But I'm also fortunate in that I got married for the first time a few years ago, and having lived a very alone kind of life, now I have this playmate who, as a psychotherapist, has converted the upstairs guest house into a telehealth center where he works with people on the front lines. He does a lot of pro bono work with doctors, and he has a massive clientele. So we don't see each other until the evenings, and I had feared we'd get claustrophobic shut in here with each other all the time, but we're like Adam and Eve in Eden, actually. We really have, our relationship has grown and grown. It was a newish relationship, a Jewish relationship. And I've gotten more Jewish and he's gotten more humanist. This period of time, we've really rubbed off on each other in a good way. So I feel very lucky. And I've had a lot of lawn distance visits with friends at a distance across the lawn until very recently when the numbers got very high here in Los Angeles. So friends would wear their masks and they'd sit in a folding chair across the lawn and we would call to one another and sometimes order out and eat lunch together at a distance. So we have survived. I've been very lucky not to be living alone. I stay in touch with a lot of my friends who are living alone and they are finding Zoom and virtual platforms a great social sphere. I actually have made a lot of new friends and revivified old friendships from back in New Haven and back in college during this time. So it's not been so bad for me.
That's great. Well, this platform that I have is all about celebrating an artist's body of worth. And what I really love about these essays and stories, the book may be new, but the essays and stories are not. You've been writing for quite some time and you are a phenomenal writer. I mean, you bring the reader and the listener right into these stories. One of the things that I read about you is that you say that the characters that you played throughout your career are that you invent these characters. And I love that. And you also teach a course in charismatizing. Did I get that correctly?
Yes.
And I love the fact that that you've created this course. Can you tell us a little bit about the course? And then I want to delve back a little in your life and career.
I'm sorry, a chorus?
Charismatizing.
Oh, this course. I'm sorry. Yeah, I've been teaching. I sort of invented this in 2003, 2004, because I was working with a lot of actors and people that needed to go into the limelight who were very awkward in an interview situation or reading their very introspective, introverted authors who were needing to read their work aloud in order to sell it. Mm-hmm. And so I created something called Charismatizing Improvising, and I use Viola Spolin's theater games. I've been teaching improv since I was in college. My acting teacher was an alcoholic and didn't come to class that often, so a cohort and I would teach the improv games as created by Viola Spolin. And we would act out Nichols and May albums. So I've been an improv aficionado for a long time. And I find it's very helpful for behavioral modification. I find that people can create characters that are more charismatic than themselves and take those characters on in life. So utilizing vocal projection and body language and emotional connection, like I've resourced as an actor for my whole career, I'm able to instill non-professional people with these abilities to really work the camera, work the microphone, and work interpersonal relationships in person, not in a manipulative way. You know, charisma can be, like anything, can be used for good or ill, but for hopefully reasons to express your competence and your bon ami in the world, your goodwill toward the world. And I have therapists, attorneys, Christian journalists, all sorts of politicians working with me. I don't advertise my classes very much. It's mostly word of mouth. The right people have found me. Mm-hmm. And currently I'm working one-on-one on Zoom with clients all over the world. That's the great thing about the virtual. You know, you can really get involved with people in Australia and Japan and Detroit and impact their lives in a good way.
So do you think charisma is something that can be taught?
I do. I mean, I don't think I can make everybody their most charismatic selves. Their will has to be into it. But I definitely know things that can help a person overcome their social awkwardness and shyness, their lack of clarity vocally, to use their bodies in a inviting way rather than a push away way. So definitely I have found I can also excavate people's funny bones that don't think they have a sense of humor. Mm-hmm. Utilizing improvisation, I've been able to help a lot of people add a lightness to their communications and their lives.
Now, again, getting back to your book, one of the things that I really admire is your openness and your honesty. Mm-hmm. And some of it is brutally honest. You talk about the suburb that you lived in. You refer to it as an amusement park. And you're originally from New Haven, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm. Suburb of West Haven, where we moved when I was in my younger years.
When did you first discover that you had charisma?
I'm not sure I even conceived it, really, that I had charisma. I wasn't very popular in grade school. I wasn't really very popular until I got into acting and the arts and writing. And then I just grew. I had a play put on in the fourth grade that I had written. And when I didn't get the lead in that, I was very mad and decided I'd better become an actor so I could cast myself in my own parts.
This was the Queen's Dress?
Pardon me?
The Queen's Dress?
Wow, you read closely. Wow. You've done your research. I almost feel naked. Yes, the Queen's Dress was a big hit in fourth grade. Everybody loved it except me because I wasn't in it. I felt very left out. So I started studying acting, and these things gave me more confidence. You know, my sister and I had been very defensively funny growing up, because if we could get our parents to stop fighting and get them laughing, things were much more benign in our household. My parents did not have a happy relationship, and they were together for 42 years. I finally asked my mother, why are you leaving after 42 years? And she said, you know, enough is enough. It's
Well, she got there. You know, good for her.
And she's 97. She's living in Hamden in an assisted living facility. And God love her, she has worked on herself constantly to get out of the mental strategy that she was in that allowed her to stay married to my dad all that long.
Now, with a lot of my interviews, I always go back to the five-year-old self. And that's that little girl or little boy before the layers of peer pressure and school and all of those are laid on. But you tell a great story of wanting to crawl into your television set. And so, which I love this story because and there are so many things where, as I'm reading, I'm going, well, I can relate to that because I was that kid as well. But what was it that was in there that wanted to pull you into that world? Before you even knew what that world was.
Right. Not having a happy family situation, I saw television shows as happy families. Mm-hmm. And whenever I was in a play, a temporary happy family was created around in the community around making the play. And that became like a religious thing for me. A theater became like a temple where everybody committed to a belief for a short period of time, for the run of the contract or the run of the play. And our believing altogether in this imagined story by some writer made us feel like a community of close family. And we were very loving. We were all, because we're accessing our feelings, we're very huggy, lovey-dovey people. So I continued to seek out these transient communities because I didn't really have family to fall back on.
Well, I'm reading a wonderful book now, also Jeff Goins, The Starving Artist. One of the things that he says in the book is that most artists are misfits and we seek out other misfits in terms of building a sense of community. You talk, one story that really struck me in one of your essays was you feeling, I mean, you not being popular in school and getting a note from a secret admirer. Can you talk a little bit about that? And don't give away everything. We want people to read the book.
Yes, we want people to buy the book. Oh, my God, it's so important. Do you have the book there?
I've been listening to the Audible book, so I don't have it.
Okay. Yes, I was not popular. I felt very awkward. I felt awkward at home, too. But people didn't get my jokes. They didn't like my laugh. I had a hyena laugh, so I was ashamed of laughing. And I always sat at the end of the rows. Nobody wanted to sit near me. So I was never in the middle where the popular girls sat. You know, all those little earmarks of not being wanted, never chosen for teams, not chosen for square dance partnership. So somebody left a letter in my vent of my locker one day, and it had flowers on the front, and it was a crayon drawing. And inside it said, "I am your secret admirer. I think you are nice, and I think you are pretty, and you are good at singing." And I was thinking it was a joke, you know, or some sort. But I kept reading it and reading it in the halls walking. And I wanted somebody to notice that there was somebody that liked me. I had evidence. And finally, I was reading it in class again and again. And one of the girls said, "What is that?" And I said, "It's from my secret admirer." And she wanted to read it. And she passed it around. And everybody started saying, "Who is it?" And I said, "I don't really know." And so, well, we have to find out. I said, "Okay, we do." So I suddenly had this phalanx of girls and eventually boys reading these new letters that came every few days over my shoulder. And then there were hints. It was like a scavenger hunt, you know, that he would leave me a note on the tree where I usually walked past on my way home, and everybody came with me. I was getting this gang of people. And he said he would reveal himself at lunch on a Wednesday, at when the 12:50 bell rang at the end of lunch. He would have an apple on his tray, and he would take a bite out of the apple and look right at me. And then if I liked him back, I should smile. Anyway, I don't want to give away too much of the story, but it was quite a turning point, quite a monumental experience. I learned a lot about being popular.
Mm-hmm. Read the book, because, I mean, it hit me between the eyes when you get to the quote-unquote punchline.
Yeah.
For lack of a better term for it.
I did not marry him, but I did marry somebody else. There's the spoiler. I did not marry them.
But you got to read the book. You got to read the book. So who were some of the teachers along the way who made a huge impact on you, on your path to wanting to pursue a career as an actress? And I know that you, if I remember correctly, the first show that you auditioned for was Three Penny Opera. That was professional.
Well, I did that first at Yale University. Since I didn't feel I fit into my high school unless I was in a play, I would take the bus and audition for plays at Yale University where they did not yet have women enrolled. And I got to be a young prostitute in the Three Penny Opera, which is a story about impoverished England and the unionization of beggars and prostitutes. Very brilliant show. The score by Kurt Weill is intoxicating. It plays the chords in your heart. That's how brilliant it is. And then I was hired again to do a professional production, an equity production in New London with the New London Opera Company, I think it was called. So I was on my way, and I kind of made it clear to my parents, this is what I want to do. My father said, "Well, you need to go back to your job at Sears." And I said, "No, I don't think I belong at Sears. I'm allergic to Sears." And so that was the start. It gave me the confidence to think maybe I could make a living doing this. Mm-hmm. So my father was very important that I make a living and not be dependent on him much longer. So I always did things for money, things that paid. I didn't do much free theater back in those days.
And again, there are so many things that I'm afraid to bring out because I don't want to give away too much of the book. But with your father, and I had a similar relationship with my father, by the way. Do you feel that your father was intentionally cruel, or do you think that he thought that there was some humor in his cruelty?
My father thought he was doing us all a world of good with his criticisms. I'm sure that's what he felt. He wanted the best for you, didn't he, Richard? And my father thought he was giving me the wisdom of his experience. Now, he had been in the military for a number of years, and he had that sort of commander-in-chief's posture. He would demand respect, almost wanted us to salute, you know, in the house and respect him. And to me, the word respect was very confusing because I thought that respect was something that came out of my own body, not something that could be coerced from the outside. "You will respect me, kid," was sort of not an appealing encouragement to respect somebody. And so my sister and I had to pretend our way through the days to survive. It made us liars, you know, which all women sort of were in that Me Too generation that I lived through. We were all liars in a sense. We were all just trying to survive the patriarchy. A lot of the Me Too stuff that you read about now, we were going through too, but we couldn't reveal any of it. We had completely shut it down. If find ourselves at fault. But I think a lot of young women like me who were cute learned to commodify their objectification by men and use that to our advantage. Mm-hmm. I was a go-go girl, you know, at Yale University mixers and at nightclubs, and, you know, earned some money. And
you were dancing at a wedding and Phil Spector.
Oh, actually, at a bar mitzvah.
At a bar mitzvah.
With this other wonderful girl named Pam. She was very wholesome. And we imitated all the moves that we saw on various television shows. Hullabaloo, you know, Clay Cole, Bandstand. And we had coordinated steps. I mean, we were very professional. Mm-hmm. And she was a model already at the age of 16. So she knew how to work a contract. So she had me, team up with her. And we started making, you know, well more than the minimum wage when we were 15 and 16 years old.
Mm-hmm. And so you were doing this in high school?
In high school, yeah. And my father wouldn't have allowed it if I wasn't making good money more than I was making babysitting. He had a business head on his shoulders and he said, well, as long as you know you get home by midnight. So I was allowed to do it and I felt more self-esteem earning money. What is it with money that it just makes you feel better about yourself? Money and then good work, you know, doing good work.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I'm done.
No, as you were pursuing a career, as you were moving forward with pursuing a career, were you doing the things and making the choices that you were making for self-fulfillment? Or were you doing these things because you wanted to impress your parents and those who you felt had not really been there in a supportive fashion?
Both. I mean, I think I had a need to earn a gainful living and feel like I wasn't dependent on somebody that did treat me well.
Was that your guiding force in terms of pursuing the work that you pursued?
It was making a living, but I also would just go after things that just seemed like they'd be fun to do. I wasn't as discerning in terms of career strategizing as I might have been. I was aroused by good money, good people to work with, safe environments, functional rather than dysfunctional shows. In fact, doing Fridays, I have to say, I do talk a bit about this, much like Saturday Night Live, was a very dysfunctional, drug-infused atmosphere. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of stress and tension, a lot of competition, desperation for ratings that I didn't share. I wanted to do good work. I didn't care so much about being like sensationalistic, but our producers were very interested in being sensationalistic because that got us press and that got us ratings. So that was often in conflict with what I personally felt comfortable with as an artist. I had studied with Stella Adler. I had done Broadway shows. I'd done Moliere on Broadway with the Young Vic, a British acting company. I mean, I felt a certain pride in my work, and to have that kind of sullied by somebody like Andy Kaufman, who was a buddy of mine, but very bent on negative attention, was really hard for me. I had to go along with it. I had a contract, but and that's when I began to realize what an entrapment contracts can be. But it was a fun show in terms of us breaking the fourth wall and breaking a lot of rules and going off in a different direction than Saturday Night Live, which was what ABC had wanted us to be. They wanted us to clone the Saturday Night Live show that had been on for a few years before us. So it was an awakening. You know, it was almost a dehumanizing awakening. Mm-hmm. I had been in a Broadway show that similarly felt more interested in props and attention than did about the safety of the actors or the comfort of the actors. So it was kind of shocking to realize it wasn't going to be like school plays. Mm-hmm. It wasn't necessarily going to be like a summer stock or community theater. It was going to be a little more exacting and rough.
Well, I'm going to go back to your early days and the transition to getting to New York and Broadway. How did that transition take place for you?
I knew I wanted to be in New York and I wanted to get good training and I knew I wanted to be on Broadway. Doing musical theater on Broadway was a major goal for me. Mm-hmm. So I went to a college on Long Island, which had a train station right at the edge of the campus. So you could actually commute into New York City. And I was able to start my professional career while I was in college, getting into summer stock productions, doing soap operas, So that was my intent, you know, when I first saw Broadway shows, was I want to do that. I'm gonna do that. And I was fortunate enough to get to do it. And then television called, and I started getting brought out here. And I found that that also pleased me and entertained me. I mean, I was on Wonder Woman. Who could not have a great time doing that?
But you mentioned soap operas. You were on Search for Tomorrow, and you were on Search for Tomorrow for how long were you actually on the show?
I was just there a short time. I always had bit parts. And then I was on All My Children and One Life to Live for a little longer. I had like a couple lines a week. It was a very small part, but I learned a lot about being on camera, timing with all the terms, action, cut, standby, you know, all those things met. There's a whole vernacular for working on camera and in television that you learn about hitting your mark, about where the hot spot of a light was. And there's a lot you just assimilate through your skin when you're working as an actor that not everybody naturally knows. While I have to say Adelphi wasn't the best college in the world for theater arts, it really gave us access to the real theater arts.
Now, one of the things that I ask a lot of artists is how ambitious you are. Some artists are incredibly ambitious in terms of the way that they pursue their art. And then others, you know, it's, you know, circumstances, meeting the right people, being at the right place at the right time. Where do you fit in as far as the arc of your career is concerned?
Well, I had an incredible drive to thrive as an artist in this business. Partly, as you would have suggested, to show my father that I could do it, because he had denied me so often. So it was spite, and to make a living, and also to play with the greatest people in the world, to play with the best, most talented playmates I could get to work with. And I have. I've been so fortunate to be in such heady circumstances. And, you know, I had a moment when I was reading aloud John Lennon's words, lyrics to Imagine, the night he was assassinated on live television, and we were all weeping as one. If somebody had told me 8 years before, when I saw John and Yoko, because they lived down the street from me on 72nd Street and Broadway, that I would be this close to his work and his artistry, I would have said, "You're just crazy. Shut up. You know, you don't know what you're talking about." But I've worked with the greats, and I'm so lucky, you know, to have done that.
Now, you've had many breaks throughout your career, but what was the first big break for you personally in terms of you felt, this is it, I've arrived, or do you feel that you have arrived? Some people never feel that they have arrived.
Well, there's we as artists always want more. There's always unfinished business. But there was a show, a musical that I was hired to do after I'd done Fridays. I thought doing Fridays for those 3 years and becoming a bit of a name, a kind of the girl du jour, you know, celebrity, that I would be pegged as just a sketch comedy actress. And I wanted to do something deeper. And I was offered the West Coast premiere of a musical that had been a hit in New York called March of the Falsettos. Mm-hmm. They were creating a new song for me called Breaking Down, which was a total showstopper. I got to premiere that song. And I think that success I had in that show as part of a terrific ensemble gave me a really good feeling inside. I felt, oh, this is it. I have proved that I'm not just a smart ass in a sketch, reading joke lines off the monitor, that I am also a good singer, a good dancer, an emotionally four-dimensional performer. So that felt like a real achievement. If only, you know, we only ran 6 months and not enough people saw it. For me, I felt like that was a real achievement, a real step.
And what would you consider to be the lowest point of your career?
The mother on Weird Science. Weird Science was a show that was very titillating for young boys. And the language on the show was extremely titillating. And I, you know, I did it as a favor to the producer. They had to fire someone, so I replaced her. And I really regret it. I had to stop the show sometimes while filming and say, I will not say that word. I will not. That wouldn't come out of my character's mouth. I'm the mother, for God's sake. Mm-hmm. So I'd say that was a nadir. as opposed to a zenith for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's still a bit of a wet dream for young boys, that show. I think they still watch it on YouTube and such, but, and that's fine for them, but I didn't want to contribute to that titillating kind of objective.
Well, you know, the second part of that question I was going to ask is, what got you through that period and what kept you going? I mean, were you under a long-term contract? Were you able to get out of the contract?
I was able to say no. Yeah. And then they doubled my salary. So I said yes. Because I saw it as money in the bank so that I could make some artistic choices in future. That's what we always justify. You know, mm-hmm. we rationalize all these choices. I have a friend who's an ardent vegetarian, but he'd always do these Camber commercials and give the money to Pito.
We've all done those things.
Yeah. And so you'd say, oh, what a hypocrite. But then you'd say, well, look what he's done. He's donated $500,000 to his PETA charity.
Yes.
So that's our rationale. And I can't say anything, did anything really cheap. I did have my kind of moral limits. But that's about all. I think that I enjoyed working so much that I would say yes to things just to be part of, meet new people and work, because I was sitting alone in my house. You know, I'm not somebody that likes to sit around that much unproductive. So I really love working. You know, I say yes to a lot of things and I don't really think about artistic repercussions. And if they're not completely tasteless, I kind of go with it.
And when did you start putting your life on paper?
Well, I'd actually been writing since fourth grade, but I had written poetry that was published in the New Haven Register when I was a kid. It was thought that I would be a writer. And then I started, you know, as work slowed down for older women, you know, as I got into my 40s and 50s, I was writing more screenplays and in them less. Mm-hmm. And I've had several things optioned. I wrote a two-character musical about a therapist and a patient who is so screwed up she can only sing to get her feelings out. So the therapist has to sing with her in order to heal her. That was done here at a Hollywood theater, and I performed it with John Savage, who you might remember from the Dear Theater.
Yes.
And so I've had a lot of projects that I've written that really looked like they were going to go, and then the check never arrived, and they didn't go. I continue to harbor hopes for them. There's a movie that showed in that promo that you showed a few moments ago that I shot about 20 minutes of, which is about my mom's escape from my father. It's funny and sad, and I'd love to get that made, but now it's been suggested that I should make it into a book, because a lot of producers option books and then they become films. It's a very circuitous route, but that's what I'm considering doing with that story, because it's a great story of a woman who comes into her consciousness and grows up in her 60s and 70s.
Now, I want to talk about the cover of your book. Yes. Because I know the story behind this, if you can take us there, it's such a great, great story about these. I think of it as a private moment that we have in our lives that become public moments.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. This experience that I encapsulated in what's now the first story in the book called Indecent Sexposure had to do with my turning 50 and having been celibate for a couple of years. My gynecologist advised that I use it or lose it and prescribed to me a massager, shall we say, a vibrator. And I said, where would I even get something like that? And he suggested there was a new Hustler store opening within a few days on the Sunset Strip. This is 1998, before they had the internet porn or, you know, the accessibility of toys and things like that. You didn't see much of that. And so I went at the crack of opening on their opening day and browsed around and just saw this incredible, I mean, it was like a mall in there, you know, two stories of erotica. It was just wild. Anything you'd ever imagine you thought was your little kink, they had a whole wing for it. Bed bondage and beyond.
And you describe in graphic detail some of the items that were available.
It was amazing. Yes. You know, they had novelty items like, you know, pornographic greeting cards, edible panties, pacifiers with little penises on them. You know, I don't know what your rating is on your show.
It just changed.
So it just changed.
I love it. It's great. It's fine.
Anyway, they were filming Larry Flint in there. To my surprise, I ended up being in the B-roll, standing behind him in the dildos department. And fortunately, I had a trench coat on and sunglasses, so I don't think anybody recognized me. But you have to read the book to find out what really happened and how my humiliation became public and then became less humiliating because everybody thought it was kind of cool.
Should we talk about how it went public, or would you prefer that they read the book?
I kind of like them to read it.
It reminded me, I'll tell you a funny story if you'd like to hear. I was doing an off-Broadway show in 1990 in New York, and it was a very, New York was a different town and city at that time. And one of the actors in the show, we were just talking in the dressing room one night, and he said that he had never been to a porno theater in New York. And I said, well, neither have I. And he says, well, let's go after the show tonight. So we went to a local porn that was down the street from where we were doing the show. There were many of them around. And we got our tickets. And like you, we were both hiding out. We're sitting in the back row of the theater. And this guy walks in and he said, I think those are the two actors we saw on the show tonight. And we immediately jumped up and ran out. Never saw the film or anything.
Oh, what
are you just, what are some other, but it really, it was just such a great jumping off point for the rest of the book. And I love that each of these essays and stories are different turning points in your life that we're learning about you as we're going on. And it's not just a tell-all memoir. I worked with this person and I did this and everything. It's really delving into really deep layers in a person's life. Was it always easy for you to be that exposed, to go with part of the title of your book? Or is it something that you learn to do as time goes on?
Well, I think that incident at the Hustler store began to turn my life inside out remarkably, that I realized I didn't need to hide who I was anymore and pretend to be this nice, shiny, bright, virginal Jewish girl anymore. I was 50. I couldn't get away with that anymore. So I sort of came out of the closet to myself and say, I am a woman with sexual feelings. I am a woman that wants love and wants to love and be loved. And I am a woman that, despite being a feminist and owning my own home and making my own living, I really want to be surrendering to some great guy someday. And so I think I hadn't fallen in love sufficiently with myself until around that period that I was ready to love anybody else open-heartedly in a trustworthy manner. I had a lot of relationships, some long-term, but there was always either a self-destructive mechanism in me or in the relationship itself that caused its ruination. And I really came into loving myself when I began writing, too. It was interesting that I realized that my imagination was becoming my friend and I could be alone with it and express it on paper in a way I might have once expressed it on stage. But if it was my personal feeling, not a character's feeling, but my personal feelings that were not so shameful that I should put them out. And I also realized that sort of self-exposure encouraged other women to examine their motivations and their hang-ups. Erica Jong said something a number of years ago. I heard a talk. She was talking about how she only writes a book when there is a hunger in the culture for the words she wants to talk about.
Wow.
I've been thinking about, during the Me Too thing, that a lot of younger women don't know but what us older women suffered and how we coped and how we self-destructed back in our maturation years. And I thought, this needs to be told. So then the urge to express this story so that other people could learn from it became bigger than any shame or inhibition I had about it. The other thing was falling in love and marrying at 65. I would tell young career women that I'd meet along the way that I was finally in love, really, and found my mate and my milieu at this advanced age. And they would all say, you give me hope. You give me hope. I want to hear your story. So that was, there was a lot of motivation to put it all together and get this book out and done.
Now you also have, your stories have been told on stage and everything. Have others told your story as well? Or has it only been through yourself as a vessel?
I think some people have sung the songs I've writ, But I don't think anybody has done these stories right now. I'm kind of hoarding them until I get my use, until I've had my fill of them. But I'm hoping others will embody these stories. I'm really hoping that Modern Love picks up some of these stories for their television, you know, streaming series. I think
They should. They absolutely should. I want to talk a little bit about your process in terms of your writing. When, I mean, do you have specific times that you write, or do you write when you get a seed or a light bulb that goes off? And do you share your stories with other people before publishing them? To get the reaction of other people?
I am fortunate to have been invited into a writer's group of published writers, much more experienced, much more successful thus far than I. And we all mentor one another. We bring in work every week and we discuss our stories. And people will uniformly say, ick, don't go there. Or they will say, oh, go more there. And that's been invaluable. I started taking.
But excuse me, Melanie, but when that happens, don't you feel that what they are bringing at that moment is their own life experiences and their own comfort level in terms of what they want to hear or what they don't want to hear?
Yes, I take that into account. I sort through different opinions. You know, I will submit these stories to literary magazines. And only some will get published. Only some people like my particular style. So the main thing is I'm like a heat-seeking missile, finding my niches where I'm welcomed. And I know where I'm probably not welcomed. And I think that discernment has been good. I'm not for everybody. My book is not for everybody. But for the people that it's for, they're really digging it. And that has become...
Well, it's a great book. It's really good.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, love it.
I want to do more. It's word of mouth that will really make this success for me. I'm not on a hit television show at the moment, just in reruns. So I don't have the platform of a television series engine, press engine working for me. So shows like yours, thank you very much, and others are ways of sort of getting word out. And people who are buying the book are buying it for their friends. And that's a wonderful way. So it may have a long tail, as they say. It may be a slow rollout. I've sold, you know, a few hundred of each version of my book right now. It will take a lot more than that to make it a hit.
Well, there's, I mean, so many great stories in the book. And I know it's over the course of a lifetime, these stories. But putting them all together in one form, have you sat down and read from start to finish the order of the arc of your story? And what has surprised you the most about yourself sitting down and reading your own words on paper?
Well, thank you. Much more streamlined in my writing. I have been very smart ass, clever punster, you know, love wordplay. And I thought, oh, what a pain in the ass this girl is. I just really had to start to curb my love of words somewhat, become more economical in my use of words. So I'm proud of myself for that. It's more spare than it was when I started. I had an editor in New York. She had edited my friend Richard Lewis's similar tone of an analogous sort of memoir, stories from his youth. And it was poignant and funny at the same time as it can be. And I used her, and she would tell me, you don't need to do another story about, you know, the kids because you already covered that here. So take that out. And you don't need to do another story about a crazy man there because you've already done four over here. So she really helped me thin out and take out a lot of the stories that had been clogging, you know, the book. So now it's 35 tight stories, and there isn't a kind of an arc. Some of them are retrospective, and they look back to the past and toward the future. But most of them kind of struggle along in this kind of spiral of failing and healing, failing and succeeding, getting smarter and smarter. And of course, the great thing was I could have finished this book in my 50s. I had a lot of these stories in mind from the past, but I would have been walking happily into the sunset with myself, you know, which a lot of memoirs end up doing. But then when I met the guy that I was going to marry, it was like, oh, I can add on a whole other happy ending here and a whole other learning curve about loving another.
Well, you may have just answered my next question, but beyond that, when did you know that it was time to give birth to this book?
I think when that literary agent said to me, this is a book. It's got literary value. It's got catharsis. It's emotional. It's not just a lighthearted celebrity Hollywood tell-all by any means. She said that the names that you use are because you had an emotionally tumultuous turning point with those people, not because you want to say, look who I know. And she was very encouraging. And that gave me the balls to go on and sit down and be alone with it for a year and finish it.
Now, I have a neighbor who's a writer. And after her husband died, she wrote a memoir. And in the book, she writes that she found 2 weeks after he passed away that she was literally skipping down the street.
Yeah.
And she, but she shared this with her sons before writing the book.
Wow.
And I want to know if I should leave this in or take it out. And they said, if that's what you were experiencing, leave it in, because it really paints a picture. And this is not to say that she didn't have a loving marriage, because she did, but she felt for the first time in her life that she was truly her own person. Yeah. And that was a major turning point in her life. I want to ask you, what kind of response have you gotten from those that you consider to be the closest friends in your life with your stories that you've shared?
They love it. They feel like I'm hanging out talking to them. And I have revealed things they didn't know about me, which you don't bring up in mixed company or at a dinner party or at a backyard barbecue. I go deep into intimacies that they never knew I had in my head or heart. Mm-hmm. A lot of my cousins said, you know, we knew from the outside what was going on in your family, but we had no idea what it was really like in there. It was like hell's a poppin' in that house. It was mm-hmm. just crazy. And my father was a very passionate character. And so it was kind of the level of grand opera was going on in her home all the time. Little things like spilling my milk became life and death crises. I mean, it was really a difficult span. Fortunately, I've spent much more of my life outside of my home, my family of origin, than I spent in it. I was only there for 15 and a half years fully. And so I think I went into therapy, and once I'd been with my therapist 16 years, I felt like, oh, well, I have a new perspective now. I finally.
Jane Fonda says there needs to be a statute of limitations on how long you hold on to that. When were you able to let go? And was this after the years of therapy that you finally came to this conclusion that that was then, this is now? Or is it still very much a part of your persona today?
I think writing the book has been, you know, cleansing for me. Always when I put lightheartedness and humor into looking these scenarios and see the funny, it really does help me absolve my family and myself of what we could have done better, punishing ourselves for what we could have done better. Yeah, I think it's been very, I use the word cathartistic. To me, that's an artistic experience that also rids you of unwanted karma and anguish. And I think the book has helped heal me. I kind of did my own therapy doing the book. I haven't been in therapy for a very long time, but I sort of really got onto my habits of thinking, you know. In the very end of the book, when my husband asked me to marry him in a very awkward and unromantic situation, I realized because I'd been hanging with my mother that evening for an hour and we were pushing each other's buttons, I had reverted like to a past version of myself, like one of the early degenerate iterations of self-recrimination mm-hmm. and judgment, seeing myself from other people's point of views instead of my own. And then I pull myself together and reassemble, you know, but it was like, oh, that's still in there. That cauldron of confusion is still in there, and I have to stay on the rim above it, look down, use it for creativity, but not live in there, not sit in there anymore. I have a much happier life now. It's a real reinvention. You know, I'm somebody who had menopause, then had Medicare, then got married. So I've done everything ass backwards, and now I have wonderful stepkids and a god grandchild. So belatedly, I'm having a lot more life than I had when I was just acting life.
Well, that's wonderful. And I'm very happy about that. With the stepkids, I mean, did you become friendly with them prior to the marriage? I mean, how long were you together before you knew this is now I'm ready? This is it.
Well, I fell in love with the kids before I let myself fall in love with him, which was awkward. And I started yearning for them, you know, before I let myself yearn for him. And I'm thinking, oh, this is dangerous. I can't get too attached to these children who might leave my lap all too soon, you know. So I would be reserved at the holidays with his wonderful extended family. He has three brothers. I've only had a sister, so having brothers is really cool. And they all have families, and you know, there are all these other milestones besides my own to celebrate. But it took me a while. I didn't know that we were going to get married. I thought maybe we would just live together. And I didn't really realize how much I wanted to marry until he asked me. And then I realized, oh, some new area has just of security and trust has just opened up in me that I never had, that I had been kind of curtailing from expressing because I was never thought I'd fully have that.
Now, I want to ask you, are you able to really enjoy where you are right now with the book and this process of getting your story out to a wider audience? And I hope that many of our listeners today will rush out and get the book. That's my goal.
I hope so. Yeah, I'm feeling pretty great about myself, Richard. Thank you for asking. I'm sure there'll be a new yearning for a new goal. I am not one of those people that sits on my laurels for very long. I'm yearning to do a good recurring role on some series, some streaming thing. I'm hoping the opportunity avails. There's so many of us X-series regulars who are all stellar and charismatic and full of talent who get shunted aside in favor of big movie stars like Meryl and Diane Wiest and Diane, Keaton and all those wonderful actresses, they all get the roles that so many of us older actresses could also play. Mm-hmm. We just don't have that kind of screen power yet. So we're all clogged in here waiting for the next great role to present itself.
Well, I want to ask you, are you a binge watcher? Are there certain shows that you're watching now that you really said, I'd love to have an opportunity and a shot at that?
A lot of the shows I'm yearning to be part of have already concluded their filming. So I recommend shows like The Restaurant, which is a Scandinavian series about a classic restaurant right after World War II, where they're sort of evolving out of a Nazi clientele into a more ally clientele. Brilliant.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
There's so many wonderful things like Borgen, which is about a Danish prime minister, a female Danish prime minister. Any one of these shows I would have loved to have been a part of. Upcoming, it's hard to foresee, you know, what will be next. I sure hope I'm in the running for some of these imaginative new comedies and shows that are being developed. I'd also love to pull my singing out of the closet and participate in something musical, if that avails itself. I'd like to be part of a variety show. You know, I'm sure that will be another format of a variety show in the future that I can fit into. And I have a manager and she's scouting for me. She doesn't send me out on those little walk-on roles, you know, so I don't work as much as we would all like. She only sends me in on the larger roles.
Well, would you be interested in coming to New York when this is all behind us and doing a cabaret act in New York City?
You know, I have my life here. I'm not sure I'd relocate for a cabaret act. I'd relocate for a television series. And I'd want my husband to come with me now that he's so portable with his work being all telehealth.
That's good.
Come with me. He'd love it. We love New York, especially when theater is alive and well. So definitely can conceive that anything is possible. I'm still fortunate to have my health and my optimism, and I have a lot more support than I used to have. And I want to see my mom. That's one reason to go back east to see.
Absolutely. And God bless her. I mean, she sounds incredible.
Yeah, well, she's brave, and she's had some physical difficulties. She had a little stroke, and so she'll probably have to have 24-hour care now. Her brain is still sharp, but her left leg is not working as well. So I just want to get there and hug her. You know, we both had both shots now.
So. I hope so. And yeah. Is there another book coming forward from you? Or I know this has just happened, but is there another book that we may be looking forward to?
Well, I'm compiling these Corona poems. I have one at the end of my book, Odd Woman Out, but I've been, you know, putting together these silly, you know, stories in verse. Some are funny, some are black comic, you know, funnier, involved with the depression of this period. Some are mournful. And I'm not sure that the Corona poetry will be, you know, will be popular once we have herd immunity. I'm not sure how people will
take it. You never know. You never know. Well, I can't believe this, but we are at the end of our show. When I sat down and I started to listen to your Audible book, and I first heard about Tyrone, I thought, what kind of a journey am I about to embark upon? Read the book, everyone. Don't say any more than that. But it's just been such a thrill. I've admired your work for so long. To get to know you. I mean, Friday nights I watched religiously. Even, you know, it was so out there on so many levels. And at some, I wanted to make this all about you. At some point, I want to sit down and talk about Andy Kaufman. What an incredible journey that he took. But in any case, I want to thank you so much, not only for being able to share your stories, but being here today and sharing with me, and for me to get to know you a little more beyond the pages of your book. I thank you so much for that. I want to let everyone know that tomorrow afternoon, if you're around at 5 o'clock, I have a show that I do every other Thursday, Creativity in the Age of COVID, with Dr. Judy Bloom, who said to say hello to you. She said you actually worked together many years ago.
I'm honored. Hello, Judy, wherever you are.
So, but we do this every other Thursday. We have three surprise guests, which I will be announcing later today. If you enjoyed the show today, I hope you all did. Please go to my website, richardskipper.com. Sign my guest book with your thoughts about the show if you haven't done so already. That helps to boost me in other markets. I also end every show by telling everyone to go out and do something nice for somebody else without expecting anything in return. Go to your Facebook friends list, and the third name that pops up today, pick up the phone and call that person. Not a text message, not an email, not a private message, a phone call, just to let them know what they mean in your life. As my dear friend David Friedman says, we're all in this together, but we're not in the same boat. And you never know what someone else is going through. And speaking of doing something nice for somebody else without expecting anything in return, go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble and get two copies of Odd Woman Out. And what you should do is keep one for yourself and send the one to the third friend on your list. And before we end today's show, Melanie, I'm going to ask you to have the final word. Anything that you want to say to build upon anything that we talked about today, anything that we didn't talk about that you wish we had, or just any message that you want to put out to anyone who's listening now. And again, thank you for your body of work and all the work that you bring to all of us. Thank you.
I think it's important to remember to let little things be large in your life now. Let little things touch your heart, little things grow you love and optimism, and let yourself be touched.
Thank you. Make it a better day. Thank you.